Hi, I'm Josh.
And I'm Lindsay.
And this is the Hideaway Podcast, episode 39.
39.
What should we talk about first?
Well, the first show we saw this week was Cuisine and Confessions.
Cuisine and Confessions.
Spoiler alert. They throw flour at the end of the show.
Into the audience
and all over themselves. And if you're a celiac like myself and can't inhale flour, you should not go to the end of the show. No. Leave before bows. Or else...
Well, what happened?
So I inhaled it. And I just felt so sick for the rest of the day. But the show was really good.
Yeah, the show was great. Sydney and Melvin, who are two acrobats from St. Louis, and they were amazing. They did this really, really good hoop diving act. There was this guy, Matthias, who did a Chinese pole number with, like, some insane drops and an amazing story about amazing. His dad. Yeah, some really, really awesome cast members. Cool to see the Seven Fingers back in New York at my alma mater,
NYU. Yeah. There is something, though, that I have a question about as far as using the performers' actual life stories as what gives the show a narrative. They had the performers, like, sit down, the director and creator of the show, and just talk about their lives and while they record them. And specifically for Melvin and Sydney's act, their actual voices are played while they're doing their number.
Yeah, this is the confessions part of Cuisine and Confessions. Yeah.
And everyone's telling a bit of their story with their number, but theirs to me was, like, the most... theirs in... and the
Matthias,
Chinese Bowl. I just wonder if that's... I don't know, because the Chorus Line became a whole lawsuit, basically, about how you can't really use people's stories in that way and not give them creative credit for that or royalties for it. And I obviously don't know how Seven Fingers is dealing with it, but just having their life stories as what is driving that number, to me, just doesn't feel... I don't know. I mean, like, it's a really powerful moment. So in that sense, as an audience member, I really enjoyed it. But like, from a ethical standpoint, I just don't like the fact that their actual stories are what is making the show interesting in a story sense.
Yes, I know what you're saying. I mean, Seven Fingers do this kind of thing a lot. And sometimes often I think they nail it. Obviously, they nailed it the most when it was the Seven Fingers speaking about themselves originally, because it was all performer created and all, you know, no conflict of interest or no sense of using somebody else's essentially sad story for your show's benefit. But, you know, I think these dudes are probably pretty keen to do it and like the idea. And, you know, no one was forced into it, I don't think.
No one was forced into it.
No.
And, like, frankly, it's a really powerful moment. The two moments are, like, incredibly powerful. They stay with you. You think about
it
after.
You remember afterwards, yeah.
Yeah. So in that sense, Shana did an amazing job, really killed it with that. I'm just thinking of from a different point of view of, like, stories and whose are they to tell.
Yes.
And that's a question.
Particularly in circus. We saw another circus show this week.
Circus 1903.
Man, so it was at Madison Square Garden, but we were going to Madison Square Garden when Penn Station had a stampede. And people were stampeding past us out of Penn Station.
People thought they heard a taser, and they thought it was gunshots, so they were stampeding away.
But Google this. Like, there's some crazy, crazy footage of, like, a real stampede out of Penn Station.
And, of course, we were coming out of Penn Station to go to Madison Square Garden, and people were like, turn around, go down, do not come outside. And I have a very high flight reaction, so I wanted to flee. And
I was like, no, we got to go see the circus.
So we went and saw the circus. And
I thought the New York Times did a really interesting description of this show. It's a circus show by the team who made the Broadway magic show, The Illusionists. And what they are clearly really good at is sort of these large scale theater shows that have a very high degree of technical level, have a good sort of magic style based host, and good costumes, good set, good story. But everything is sort of just good and well executed upon, but nothing really, to me, elevated. Maybe the puppets could have done that, because rather than having real elephants, they had puppet elephants. Mm-hmm. But you and I were talking about this a little bit afterwards, is that the thing that's weird about elephants is people who feel like that's animal cruelty to have animals on stage doing tricks. But even if they're puppets, you are romanticizing that idea. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to divorce one's feelings about animal rights in the circus from an act, even though it's puppets. And I think that just creates an odd mm-hmm. tension within my, at least myself.
Yeah. The way in which they used the puppets was kind of, I don't know, you have this opportunity with a puppet, right, to make it do anything you want because it's not a real animal. And at least have someone riding the elephant or, you know, yeah. like if we were going back to 1903, doing that moment with an elephant rather than just having the elephant puppet walk out, drink some water, and then a little baby elephant run out and then go into intermission.
Yeah.
But I agree with you. Everything was good. It was all good.
The way the New York Times said it was that it wasn't as spectacular as Cirque du Soleil, as like showy as Ringling, or as intimate as Big Apple. But it's not a criticism of the thing. Mm. It sort of just lacked a little bit of whatever that special flavor yeah. is.
I mean, I think like also after, you know, doing Slumber, our show, it's really hard to create a show that feels unique and feels
like something's like a new voice.
Yeah, but also like satisfies people yes, who want
exactly.
something.
That's a satisfying product.
Because you can create something new, but it cannot be satisfying.
Yes.
Right? And like Circus 1903 was a new product, right? They're using puppets. It's a little bit more quote unquote story driven, which I really don't think it is. It's, you know, it's like the classic like act, ringmaster act. But you always like a little unsatisfying.
One of the things that jumping all over the place, I've been wanting to talk about the podcast since I read this article, is the question is, did Disney kill Ringling? The fan theory on the internet.
Fan theory. I mean, you read me the article, but why don't you tell people what the theory is?
So I'll link the original article in the description. But basically, this guy theorizes that the reason Ringling is closing is because Disney could potentially buy Feld Entertainment, which owns Ringling. So Feld Entertainment has, I think it's 27 shows, only two of which are Ringling. The rest are essentially Disney properties on ice or Monster Truck Jams that are things that Disney doesn't own. But
or Marvel.
Marvel's a Disney. Exactly. Marvel Live is Disney. They do their shows. And Monster Truck is something that Disney could own mm-hmm. and would be appealing and has this crossover audience and could be tied in with ESPN and all these things. So they're very two symbiotic companies, and Disney gets to do the bigger strategy story stuff, and Feld is like specializes in the putting shows into all these local arena markets. And the issue is that, well, and the Felds have grown this business over like 70 years among over three generations of people and bought Ringling at one point and are now closing it. The theory goes, because it would prevent Disney from being able to buy Feld Entertainment and then to merge, which would probably mean a great payout for Kenneth Feld and his family. All the credit to them. That's why you start a business in the first place. But Disney can't be associated with animal cruelty. Like, all Disney is all about their image. Mm-hmm. And whether or not you think Ringling had animal cruelty or how you feel about animals in shows, the public thinks, mm-hmm. for the most part, that animal cruelty exists in Ringling, and those two things are associated. Even if you don't think it and don't believe it, you are aware of this, and it's an association that exists. And Disney does not want that association. Disney does also not want to buy Feld and then close Ringling, because they don't want to be the people who killed the circus.
Quote unquote.
Because again, for Disney, it's all about image, because they're a, you know, image product-oriented company. Mm-hmm. So best possible solution. Kenneth closes it, gets to blame it on PETA, and real legit reasons. But they don't have to sell it. It's not Big Apple Circus where it has to go away. Like, mm-hmm. they can close it and reopen it 5 years from now if they want, or if Disney wants to do Ringling the movie, like, they'll still own the
I
rights.
Wonder, though, if Feld sells their company to Disney, if Feld can keep the the rights to basically a portfolio, right? Yeah. If Disney's buying that whole thing and then Ringling and all that entity goes with it, or the Fells can keep Ringling and it's a separate
thing. I'm sure you could negotiate for it if you were in the Fells' position. Ultimately, I think...
But it doesn't strike...
It won't leave the Fells.
No, like, but they don't strike me, though, as like the family that wants to just do Ringling.
No, I mean, they are... They have Ringling's only been a thing they have done for a few generations.
That's why I'm wondering if they even would keep it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it just makes sense to hold on to it until somebody else wants it. Mm-hmm. When the next person comes along.
Well, maybe Bello Knock can buy Ringling from the Felts.
Exactly. They could be
I was really bummed.
Bello versus Nick Walenda for Big Apple.
I was very bummed that Bello did not get Big Apple.
Why?
Because, I mean, it will be interesting to see what happens with Big Apple. I feel like it's a industry that you really need to, like, know and love and really want to put time into understanding, because it's really not easy. And, like, what appeals to people and what doesn't appeal to people is still, for this day and age, I think is still unknown. As far as, like, specifically in New York, you know, like, Torok was here, wasn't selling super well, wasn't selling bad, you know. Curious wasn't selling well. Circus 1903 seems like it's selling okay.
We were there on a Friday night and it was half full.
Yeah, half full on a Friday night. I mean, Cuisine and Confessions.
Not sold out,
but like also, you know, short stints. So, I mean, it's interesting to see like what works and what doesn't. It seems like, you know, something like Queen of the Night did a little bit better. Not great, but it definitely did better.
Pippin. Did great.
But that's a musical. I mean, yeah. So I think it'll be interesting to see what happens with Big Apple. But I wanted it to go to, like, Bello because I feel like he grew up in the circus.
More.
Yeah, maybe he would just, I don't know.
The passing it down to a circus family is different from passing it into, I don't know, outsiders is maybe how it feels.
Yeah.
I know that they're definitely not all outsiders who are working on it, even if the people who invested in it and bought it did. They have a director that we know and love, Mark Lonergan, who's an upcoming podcast guest, and Joel Jeske, who's writing the show with him, are doing it. They did the show 2 years ago, are slated to do it again this year. They also directed Smirkus. He's doing it again this summer and did it last summer. So I have faith that Mark will pull through, whether or not like it has the same culture and vibe and poor business planning that it did before. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm hoping they don't, but I think that's harder if you're new to circus.
Yeah, I have to admit, I haven't read the articles yet, but Jessica Hentoff keeps sharing articles about how, you know, circus is not dead in America. And I like that she's sharing them, because even though you see these two massive companies closing, there is still so much circus in America. There can be and should be more. But I'm glad that Big Apple is now, you know, the resurgence of the new Big Apple. Yeah, and hopefully at some point Ringling will come back. But it's always an evolution, right?
It's always changing. So, it's that change. Speaking of people who are creating the next evolution and performers, creators of circus, is our podcast guest today.
Yes.
Who's that?
Elsie Smith.
Who is one of the founders of the New England Center for Circus Arts.
Also known as NECA.
NECA, based in Brattleboro, Vermont. Somewhere I actually trained at when I was like 14, 15, 16, 17 probably. I would drive like 2.5 hours from my town in Weston all the way up I-91.
For those of you in New England who care about the road.
Which road to get there. But I-91 will get you right there.
Google Maps
it. Like multiple times a month. Like basically every weekend. Because they would do classes for people who were in Smirkus and who were teenagers. Who were for sure one of my instructors early days was our guest, Elsie. Who has an amazing performing career that's included Cirque du Soleil and gigs and little tours around the world. While simultaneously also being the founder of the U.S.'s longest-running professional circus school. And
with her sister.
Her twin sister, Serenity.
Every time she talks about her and her twin sister, it reminds me of the musical Sideshow. Because it's all about the twin sisters doing their act together.
Yes.
Granted, there are Siamese twins in the show. And Serenity and Elsie are not Siamese twins.
No.
But they do this, like, twins. Trapeze act together. And every time she talked about it in the circus, I was like, I would just be going through the soundtrack of Sideshow.
And I really loved this conversation we had with Elsie. We really talked about some interesting things when it comes to teaching circus, what's changed about the learning circus and creating material and circus research just in the last 10 years, what it's like to start a circus school and grow it from a room in a warehouse to this new massive building that they're currently building and still fundraising for. And just, you know, what circus life is like, somebody who's been in their entire life, who's made it work, has done it, you know?
Yeah. I had to leave about 20 minutes into the conversation, if that. So I drop out of the conversation early, but it's because I wasn't there, not because I had nothing to say. But so I'm as excited as everyone listening to hear the interview. But if you like our podcast, make sure to like us on Facebook, follow us on Instagram, rate us on Instagram, like us on Instagram. No, sorry, iTunes. Follow us on Instagram and Twitter, tweet us. And Elsie asked us to tell you about their Kickstarter campaign,
which we mentioned a few times in the show, but check the link in the description. Go give now, support their new trapezium. That's what it's called, the trapezium.
That's hard to say, trapezium. Support their new trapezium.
Enjoy your interview with Elsie Smith. But you're from Western Mass originally, right?
I was born and raised in Huntington, Massachusetts, which is basically where you can't get anywhere to there. You know, it's the middle of nowhere.
Did circuses come to that part of Massachusetts?
I didn't see a circus until after I started working for the circus, and I was 18 years old. So I grew up in, like, a little log cabin with no running water and electricity. And my parents were actually living in a tent when we were born. And my dad had been kicked in the face by a horse that he was using to build the cabin with. It was sort of like catatonic for a month. And then they thought they were going to have one boy in March, and they got two girls in January, and threw us in the back of a little Volkswagen Beetle and drove to Florida to get away from the winter. And
something
then went back
that
and built
seems
the house.
Very circusy, even though it's not that circusy.
Like the gypsy caravans.
The gypsy caravan, the sort of communal living, because it wasn't hippie, but it was communal, back to the land, you know, everybody gardening together, separate cabins kind of thing. But it's just like being on tour with a bunch of circus people where you have like separate rooms, but you have this communal eating and travel lifestyle.
Did you do dance or gymnastics? Or
I climbed trees and worked in my dad's sawmill and was a bookworm, basically. I would take my books up into the trees to get away from all my brothers and sisters.
Do you have more siblings than just your twin Serenity?
There's a lot of us. Yeah, there's five, seven, or eight, depending on how you count it.
Oh, wow. And you're the only two who ended up in circus.
We pulled our brothers and sisters in. You know, my little sister helped. She taught at Smirkus Camp when Bill and Serenity, my sister and her husband, taught at Circus Smirkus Camp. My brother went on tour of a Circus of the Kids with us for a little while and claims that being able to fire eat helped him get into law school. But they are not aficionados at this point in time. They're just supporters.
So what was the first circus show that you did see?
Vidbel's Old Time Family Circus in Monticello, New York. I'd gotten a summer job teaching at French Woods Festival for Performing Arts. So both Serenity and I were there. And about halfway through the summer, Bruce Pfeffer, who was the person who ran Circus of the Kids, which is the company that was on site at French Woods that year, he took a whole bunch of us to see this little touring family circus. And I've since met Jenny Vidbel, and who was with Big Apple Circus for a while.
She was an animal act.
She's an animal act, yeah.
There was a whole article about what she was
her
doing with all the animals. Yeah, right.
She's pretty amazing, and her sister's an aerialist because she's actually a twin also.
So. Oh, she is?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Wow.
Yeah. So that was my first experience, was a really traditional mud show.
And what about learning circus?
Pretty much I got to fly in the flying trapeze like twice, and then I showed up at French Woods and they said, great, you don't have any circus experience. And I said, nope, but I'm here. And we spent about 2 weeks learning fire eating, trapeze, trick roller skating, how to spot the rolling globe, how to set a Spanish web. And then they sort of, you know, let us teach kids.
What was appealing to you about it?
That I was away from home was the main reason, and that I had a summer job. Like, that's really why. I'd had two opportunities to do a little bit of circus before that, just, you know, like a week at a Club Med, and doing something that was completely foreign to anyone that I knew was really special. You know, to be able to go back to my little tiny high school in the middle of absolutely nowhere, Massachusetts, and feel special was really why I enjoyed circus.
And what took you and your sister out of Massachusetts?
The circus. So after a year, actually after a summer at French Woods, I basically ran away and joined the circus. And Serenity took a couple more months because she'd had an injury. And then she got called up by Ringling Brothers because we had a friend who was working with us at French Woods. And there was an opening for a dancer. Remember, we never took dance lessons. who did Spanish Web. And they called us up. And at the time, Serenity was caretaking our grandmother, who was on her way. She was very ill. And Serenity said, well, if you take my place taking care of our grandmother, I can head off to Ringling Brothers. Sure, no problem. So she 3 days later, she was on-site training for an aerial position at Ringling and toured with the Red Unit.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yep.
Do you remember what edition it was?
It was the Gunther Gable Williams Farewell Tour.
Whoa, that's super cool.
Yep. Yeah.
For those who don't know, Gunther Gable Williams was an animal trainer who was very famous for sort of changing the way that the presentation of training the animal, making it less scary and more about them being your like family and friends. So what, did you join that tour as well at some point?
No, I ended up traveling around with Circus of the Kids, teaching social circus to kids all up and down the East Coast. So orphanages and community centers and schools and things like that. So I was really learning about the art of teaching circus, but also about what teaching circus to kids and communities can do. You know, getting 300 kids to perform in a circus show after 3 weeks. And then, of course, I was getting a chance to be on stage as well because I was partnering, you know, Rollabola and partnering trick roller skating and things like that. So
how old were you guys at this point?
18.
Oh, so you guys just left right from high school and went?
Well, we did 1 year of college because we were a year ahead because we were homeschooled, you know, that whole backwards thing. We were homeschooled for a little while and so ended up in college at 17.
Where did you guys go?
University of Massachusetts.
Oh, UMass.
Yeah, we got... Serenity had gotten into Dartmouth and I got into Smith College, but because of really great scholarships, full tuition to UMass, that sort of thing, we ended up doing the state school route.
Which is, UMass now is like a really good school.
It was pretty good then yeah. too, but I also was pretty much unprepared for college in the sense that I'd been sort of on my own for a little while and also... not really sure what I wanted to do, you know, sort of academically inclined to do a lot of different things, but nothing was jumping off the plate. So when circus, you know, reared its head and was completely different and all consuming, I never ever looked back at college.
Well, I have to imagine, since I've heard a little bit about your parents, but were they supportive of the decision to leave traditional school and do circus?
They were very
supportive. That's what I would have assumed, but.
yeah it was sort of, you know, we were paying our own way because it was a job. Mm-hmm. You know, they thought, you know, as long as you're happy, and we never had to, you know, go back to them for support. So what's not to like, right?
Great. Bye. Yeah.
And you make it over to the West Coast at some point soon. Mm-hmm. In your career.
Yeah, so Serenity met her husband, Bill Fortune, on the Ringling Brothers Red Unit.
Is that his real name?
It is his real name.
Oh, my gosh.
He's actually from New Jersey.
Oh, really?
And did AMDA, the mm-hmm. American Musical yeah. and Dramatic Academy, and ended up supporting a friend to go to Clown College auditions, and he got in, and the friend didn't, so he ended up going to Clown College.
What a great stage name and a real name.
Yes, and I think his clown name was Soup Bone.
Oh, that's cute.
Yeah, so he and my sister met, and they actually were just friends for a while, and then Bill came to work for Circus of the Kids with me, and then when I left Circus of the Kids, Serenity came back and worked for Circus of the Kids. She had been touring with Farfan Circus in Japan. So then she and Bill got together while touring with Circus of the Kids and then ended up getting jobs with the Pickle Family Circus. So Bill was a performer for the Pickle Family Circus when they first moved out. And Serenity was teaching at the Little Pickle Family Circus school. And then when the Pickle Family Circus went bankrupt, the circus school that we know as the Circus Center now was developed, and it was called the San Francisco Center for Circus Arts at the time. And Serenity was one of the founding coordinators working in the office.
I always think it's so amazing how everyone is just so entwined, especially in this very specific era in the United States, just how everyone was at the Pickle Family Circus or Big Apple, and then they all rolled together.
Cross-pollinated.
Yeah.
So were you guys like thinking about starting your own circus school when you saw the San Francisco one happening, or was that way down the line?
Never. At the time that my sister got involved with starting the circus school in San Francisco, I had moved to Canada. I'd followed a person there. And where we were in Northwestern Ontario, there wasn't any circus. So I got into teaching trampoline, and I'd never taken trampoline. I just had some experience with teaching, and they suggested that, you know, I might want to take the trampoline coaching certification course, which at that time in Canada, you could do totally separate from gymnastics. So I was doing that while Serenity was training with Master Lu Yi to put together a partner acrobatic act with Bill. So about 3 years after that, I finally made my way to San Francisco and was pretty much, you know, working full time at a shoe store, training a very little bit, just, you know, to make ends meet in San Francisco while Serenity and Bill were off on tour. And it was a couple years later that I ended up having the time to do more training, get a little bit more involved in performing, and then I took over teaching a lot of the classes, the aerial classes. So by then, you know, I was in my mid-20s before I even thought about really going into performing. And it was just totally by accident that someone contacted the circus school where I was running the office at the time. And they said it was Cirque Productions, and they wanted to do a audition. And I, you know, inquired what kind of acts they were looking for so I could share that out with the community. And they said, we'd really like two girls on the trapeze. And at that time, my sister had been doing trapeze with Aloysia Gavre from Cirque School LA. And Aloysia was moving on. Pickle Family Circus was going through its second bankruptcy situation. And Serenity and I just threw something together. And I got the job. So we went off for a holiday tour with Cirque Productions and then ended up spending a whole summer in Atlantic City.
Was it easy to work with your twin at first, or were there lots of like sibling challenges as far as working together and being together all day, every day?
We actually always worked really well together. I don't know if it's because we're the oldest of many siblings, but there was never really that opportunity to sort of get involved in sibling rivalry because there were so many other, you know, family members to get along with instead.
And were you training trapeze at the time, or was it a different duo number?
It was trapeze. We were always sort of, you know, first love was always the trapeze.
And you were doing swinging or static trapeze?
This was static trapeze. It was for a casino gig, so sort of low to the ground, static trapeze, easy to rig. And we'd never had any training. So you've noticed I've never said that I had a trapeze teacher. So we were really, you know, it was cold. There was no heat in the building in San Francisco. We had a couple of videos that we would look at, but essentially it was before YouTube, before any of the sort of research modalities that people use now. So we were basically crawling all over each other, trying to create new work and come up with something.
So how did that sort of act progress to the one that most people have seen on video or are aware of from when you guys were in Cirque du Soleil or afterwards?
Several years after we started performing our own trapeze act, the one that we did with Cirque Productions, we had done a couple of auditions for Cirque du Soleil. You know, we'd walk in the door and they'd basically look at us and say, well, you can't tumble. I was super proud of learning how to do a back walkover when I was 24, by the way. But they were right. I couldn't tumble. So they sent us on our merry way and then would invite us to the next audition and the same thing would happen. And then Saltimbanco which had been created with the Stebbins sisters, was a very successful show, but at that time in the early 90s or the mid-90s, Cirque du Soleil was doing their shows and then putting them away. And they had just discovered the concept of touring Europe or touring Australia and Japan, but they had closed up Saltimbanco and hired most of the performers to do O. And then they decided they wanted Saltimbanco back, and they had to find some key spots for the acts that were pre-existing. So they were looking for identical twins who did trapeze. So Sarah Stebbin came to visit San Francisco because she had some friends there, and she saw our photograph on the wall, contacted the director of the show and said, "You got to get these girls to Montreal for an audition." So we were actually flown to Montreal for a private audition. And it was Halloween, and we were terrified because, again, we'd never had a real coach. And they put us on the swinging trapeze, which was godly high off the ground, and basically said, "Jump and throw yourself around." And we basically said, "Okay, this is the only week of training I'm ever going to get in swinging trapeze, so we might as well make the best of it." And at the end of that week, they asked us to perform the act that we had created. And we thought, great, this is our chance to perform for Cirque du Soleil. And they put you in a room and then invite all of the office people to come watch. And we had a great time and thought that that was going to be the end of it. We were older than their normal demographic. We had no gymnastics background, no training. But they offered us a job at the end of that week. And it was terrifying to contemplate getting paid $50 a week after taxes when you're like paying for normal expenses. And we walked home to the hotel that night thinking, we can't possibly do this. We have to do this. What a great opportunity. We can't possibly do this. And we convinced ourselves that, yes, we would actually do it.
Was Cirque du Soleil a pretty different company, at least as far as size and culture back then than it is now? Because now it's got thousands of staff members.
And it was a very different company. As I said, they had just, you know, gotten this idea of keeping their shows going but sending them to other countries. And we got a chance to do a show that I think of as one of the sort of old good shows. Saltimbanco was not as techie as Kidam, which was sort of the next really big show that came after it. We did all our own rigging. We walked out in the middle of intermission. They lowered points down from the ceiling. We clipped our safety
lines
in.
That is very different.
Very, very different. And for me, with the background that I had with touring with more of a traditional show mentality with Circus of the Kids, putting my hands on my own equipment before I threw myself, you know, out over the audience 40 feet above their heads was really important. As a teacher, I guess I'm maybe a little bit of a control freak and I don't trust all the tech stuff. And that said, a lot of the sort of motorized systems were at their beginning technology. So with Saltimbanco, we got sort of the last of the old style shows. And it also was a very upbeat show, very fun, lively. So it was a really enjoyable show to be part of. You know, you left the site at night dancing, whereas some of the more modern shows have a darker theme to them and can wear on the soul after 4 years of touring.
So what did you tour with Saltimbanco?
Where did we tour?
Yeah.
We did the Asia Pacific tour. So we got a chance to, you know, test the show out in Montreal and in Ottawa. And then they flew us to Australia. We did 5 cities in Australia, then Singapore, Hong Kong. And then we came stateside for Seattle and Portland and then went to Japan for 14 months.
That's a pretty awesome tour. Those are all good places.
They're all awesome places. And it's especially in Japan, it's a really good place to be paid to go because it's so expensive.
So when you guys came back, what was your head at? Were you like, we want to keep touring, we want to do something different, we're over this trapeze thing, or what were you feeling?
Serenity and her husband were ready to start a family, so that was the big reason for us to finish being on the road. And we were also ready to do something that was a little bit more our own creation. So we had spent a lot of late nights in the tent, creating a new act on a new sort of slightly different trapeze. And we were backstage with the Seven Fingers folks who weren't the Seven Fingers yet, but they were working on new material. And then the folks who are Vertical Tango, Sam Payne and Sandra Foisey. So we all spent a lot of time backstage together and, you know, all had ideas of how to move forward after a Cirque du Soleil career. Serenity and Bill and I all moved back to Vermont because that's where our family had sort of shifted north during our time away from home. And we ended up in Brattleboro, Vermont, which is a small town, but it's on the train directly between Montreal and New York. And there's a airport that's really easy to get to. So we thought it would be a really great place to sort of set down roots and still keep our career going. So we created a new act that's probably the one that most people know us for, which we call Dos Chicas, which is a spinning single point act that was designed to be done in 16-foot ceilings, so we could really do it anywhere. And we ended up going out to festivals like the Wuxiao Circus Festival in China, the Albacete Festival in Spain, and we also did a festival in Mexico City. And then we did a lot of corporate work and touring with Cirque La Masque. And then we also created our own show with Nimble Arts, which is our performing company.
It must have been great, though, being able to go back to Brattleboro and be in this super rural place and have all these things take you outside of it regularly.
It's awesome. And as a sort of country kid, farm kid, you know, fingernails dirty from working in the earth person, after being on tour in major cities like Tokyo and Sydney, it was a much needed break. But it's also really fun to, you know, run off and put the spanglies on and get feted and be the famous circus performers and then come back and just, you know, be out in the middle of woods in a log cabin off the grid.
And was the first, was it called NECA originally, or was it called Nimble Arts originally, or something else?
Well, we were Nimble Arts was the company that we founded right after we got to Vermont, and we started teaching. We were working like at the Aerial Dance Festival in Boulder, Colorado. We started some teacher training workshops. And then people kept asking us, can you teach a little bit more? Can you do a little bit more? And then before we knew it, we had a couple people teaching classes for us. And then 10 years ago, we decided that in order to bring the school that we had created to the next step and to also make sure that it didn't become just a founder-driven organization, we knew that we had to create a not-for-profit. And that's when the New England Center for Circus Arts was born, specifically with the mission to create a community and a facility for circus, and in our minds, to create something that would live beyond us.
Yeah, I think I must have been taking your classes probably around that time when you guys switched to a nonprofit, because I remember driving from Connecticut like 2 hours there and 2 hours back multiple weekends in a row, because you guys did like a Circus Mercus Kids like weekend class for people all to come and do it. And it was awesome. Like, I think NECA and like the local gymnastics place were like the only two places in New England that I knew where I could get circus and acrobatic training.
Yeah, we really lucked out by having a really great relationship with Circus Mercus, like right from the get-go. Serenity and Bill had taught at the summer camp years before. So when we landed back in Vermont, it was natural for us to reconnect. And we think of ourselves as, well, sister organizations or supportive organizations. We're completely separate, but a lot of our coaches and staff work there. I've coached tour, Serenity and Bill coached tour. And like you said, a lot of the kids would come to get their sort of winter training and Smirko fix at NECA. So it's been a really great connection.
And over the years, it's gotten more and more professional, to the point at which it's probably the most legitimate professional teaching program in the States.
I thank you for saying that. We've got 10 years under our belt, and we're very, very proud of the professional training program that we've had for 10 years. It was designed as a part-time program for people who didn't have a lot of economic resources or, you know, someone to help them pay the bills. In that time, though, we've really explored what can really make American circus performers better. And so next year, so fall of 2017, is our first full-time training program. So it is going to be more expensive, but it is going to help us help people get to the professional level that they really want to, because part-time circus training doesn't get you to the level you need to get to.
Yeah. But I think just the program that has already existed, so many people have gone through it who I know who use it as this awesome stepping stone between, like, I want to do circus, I don't know how, to either doing it professionally or doing another degree in a foreign country, basically. So I saw Kevin Beverly and Emily Nicole Tucker, I just saw in Australia, and they were both talking about how they were at NECA prior to going to ENC or to Montreal to train. But it must be awesome seeing all these people having gone through your program now being legitimate performers.
Yeah, there are so many people that I think the American circus community doesn't know went through our program. We're so proud of them. There's like 120 people that have done that program. And you're right that a lot of the people did the program, and it was called ProTrack because it was designed to help bridge going from community circus or a summer camp to a professional training program. And we're really excited about our program now becoming that full-time training program so that people don't have to leave America to get it. And having a new facility is going to help us with that a lot.
So what kind of classes or things are you adding to the program that didn't exist before? What are the differences?
We're going to be able to have indoor flying trapeze and swinging trapeze. So Serenity and I, the only place that we've been able to teach swinging trapeze since we left Cirque du Soleil is at Circus Mercus. Kia and Lindsay, a lot of people know them. Isabel Patrowitz, who's a professional flying trapezist, she did swinging trapeze with me.
Yeah, she was just in Circus Vargas last season or two seasons ago.
Yep, and she's doing great. So now we're also going to have a trampoline, tramp wall, basically the kind of things you can do in a 40-foot ceiling that you can't do in a 20-foot ceiling is what we're going to be able to offer in the new full-time program.
And what kind of like level students are you looking for people who are like listening to the podcast and wondering, like, is this something I can do?
We are looking for students who will not be broken by a full-time program. But other than that, you can have a really wide range of skill sets coming into the first year of the program. So if you've only been training once a week and don't have a gymnastics or a dance background, we have a summer intensive that you can take just to see whether or not your body can hold up and whether or not you even have a passion for circus that will carry you through 3 years. But if you have been doing circus more regularly, then, you know, we've got a year one, and this year 2017, you can also apply to enter in year two. Eventually, it will be a 3-year program, and everyone will start with the first year.
Amazing. Jumping backwards a little bit, what has it been like to grow your company basically from, and I don't mean this in any kind of negative way, but essentially like one room in a warehouse to what is now going to be a pretty massive circus training space? And obviously there's also stress that comes with being an entrepreneur and doing that, but it must have been a crazy journey you guys have sort of been on in the last decade.
We have been on a crazy journey for the last decade, because not only were we growing our performing career post Cirque du Soleil, going off to festivals and things like that, we were, without any pre-planning, creating one of the largest circus schools in the United States. And we never had thoughts of creating a circus school. It really developed organically, like you said, from a small room in a warehouse. And then people would show up and say, can you teach me more of this? Can you do more of that? We had people who said, can I move to Vermont and teach for you? And eventually it became several classes a week, full time, all year long. And then we would get another studio that we would add in, and then we would add another studio, and then we found another location that had higher ceilings. So now we were working on two different locations. One of the things that happened, again, sort of by accident, because we didn't pre-plan any of this, is that we became recognized as good business people, not just crazy circus people. Our landlords are the Brattleboro Development Credit Corporation. I'll say that again, Brattleboro Development Credit Corporation. It's a mouthful. And they're an economic development location. And they developed a business plan competition that they invited us to participate in. And I said to our landlord, I said, well, we're not trying to make a big business. why should we, participate in the business plan competition? And they said, no, you are hiring people and bringing young people to the state. That's a business model that we want to support. So I was off on tour in Europe with an aerial puppet show while Serenity was pregnant with her first son. And so she got to do all the heavy lifting, writing the competition and developing the business plan. And we won $20,000. And that was really the seed money that helped us develop what people know as the New England Center for Circus Arts today.
Wow. And it is a not-for-profit, right?
It is a not-for-profit.
So how is that having a board and sort of the introduction of, essentially what are outsiders into helping you grow it?
We knew right from the very beginning that Serenity and I, as two people with a real interest in teaching circus, didn't want to be bogged down with the business side of things. Even though we have shown ourselves to be decent business people, we wanted to have enough people around us that would take the load off of us so that we could be good teachers. So having a board that was active was really important. And they've developed, now that we've been working towards the new building and fundraising for $2.5 million, they've become a lot more active by necessity. And we're really looking forward to completing all of our fundraising, completing the building, so Serenity and I can get back to more of the teaching that we are so passionate about.
Yeah, let's talk about the fundraising. How is it going? What are you guys doing? How can listeners help?
Well, we have a building plan that is in two parts. So we have a phase one and a phase two. The reason we did that is because $2.5 million is a fair chunk of money to raise, although in the grand scheme of things, purchasing 3 acres and building a full-on circus school, that is actually not a lot of money, because in Brattleboro we were able to get the property for a steal, basically. So we have raised $1.2 million out of the $2.5 million total.
That's awesome.
It's really awesome. We have a couple of sort of magic donors in the community, and then a lot of small donations is what it takes. That amount has allowed us to go ahead with the first phase of the building. So when you go onto our website and you see all the really cool pictures, you'll see the big trapezium space, which has the indoor flying trapeze, a couple of offices, the bathrooms. It's 40 feet tall. That's the first phase of the building. Once we have that built and we complete the fundraising to the $2.5 million total, we'll be able to add on some of the more intimate training studios that allow like a black box theater, and you'll be able to sort of go into a room and shut the door and have some quiet training time, plus more offices and an outdoor performance space. So for Amazing. Those of you who know Jacob's Pillow
yeah.
or Tanglewood,
That is a great idea.
Yeah, isn't it great? We need something for circus that is comprehensive with the indoor and the outdoor spaces, performances, classes, and right across the street are the hotels and the restaurants, but you can't see them because there's all the trees around you. So you can really come and be in the middle of this sort of Vermont rural experience, but have all of the services you need and a top-of-the-line, state-of-the-art, amazing, world-class circus facility.
Oh, that sounds great. I can't wait to see shows outdoors in Brattleboro. I've seen these photos of a few theaters in France that the Seven Fingers have played in. That's sort of just an outdoor amphitheater, and I'm like, oh, man, that'd be so great to see a show in that kind of setting.
Yeah, I've had a chance to perform at the Jacob's Pillow outdoor performance space, and it's magical to be sort of in lights and with professional music, but to have the outdoor space and the natural amphitheater be the stage. So we're really very much looking forward to that, and that'll be part of the second phase of the whole building.
One of the things that Lindsay and I talked about on our last podcast and noticed when we were in Australia is basically how so many young people have gone through circus programs as kids who don't become circus performers as adults, but it makes them audience members and fans and care about it as an art form. Do you feel like, or what do you see as far as the amount of people who go through it and this is just their touch with circus and or their brush in with it and now come and see shows or are aware of it versus the people who come just for like hardcore, I want to learn tricks, I want to have an act, I want to become a circus performer?
You've actually just touched on sort of part of what is the core of the mission of the New England Center for Circus Arts. We are not an elite circus school. There are other people out there that have talked about becoming an elite circus school. We are a community that is open to all abilities and all aspirations. And so someone who wants to be in Cirque du Soleil or aspires beyond Cirque du Soleil, which I think people need to start aspiring beyond that, if someone simply wants to get fit, or if someone wants to become a street performer, we are dedicated to creating a home for all of those people. And some of the programming that comes out of that is we have a high school program, for example. So the kids at the local high school, they can come to us for an hour and a half every single morning for their first period. They get elective credits towards graduation, and they get to do circus.
That's awesome.
It's awesome. They get to move. They get to learn how to stretch. They learn how to be part of a team, keep each other safe.
And then in class, you'll be like tired and sitting sedated.
Exactly. There's so much, a lot less ADD stuff going on. So they're actually more successful when they go back to their regular classroom. And those kids, if none of them end up becoming professional circus performers, doesn't faze me at all, because the whole reason for them being at NECA is about team building and physical literacy and 21st century learning skills. These are sort of catchphrases for things like teamwork and hand-eye coordination. And then, like you mentioned, they're becoming circus aficionados and circus audience members for the future, and hopefully circus supporters.
Donors later.
But the real goal is that they're part of a community and they feel good about being part of that community.
So I'm jumping around a little bit, but one of the things that I think you and your sister do really well and you don't see a lot of people do is create apparatuses. Can you sort of talk about what your process for that is and then maybe some of the things that you guys have created?
Cool. I'm glad you noticed that. I've never heard someone mention that before, but it's something that's a passion of mine. I think that I don't have a classic circus performer's physique. As I mentioned, I didn't get started till I was much older. I didn't have a tumbling background. I was never going to be able to compete against the rhythmic gymnasts who go onto the fabric and have these amazing contortion bodies and things like that. So along the way of developing our circus career, Srinidhi and I started to really look outside the box. Like, what could we do that's different so that we can show off something that's unique and special, instead of trying to have an act that is just like anybody else's act and having to compete with amazing physicality. That said, you know, we have some pretty crazy tricks that we do as well, but we wanted to create something that was eye-catching in a different way. So some of the apparatus that we've created are the Tippi Lyra, and we were inspired by a lot of other people to create what people know of as the Tippi Lyra. We don't create out of a vacuum. I also created a fabric loops act. So it's not just two pieces of fabric, it's different loops of fabric together that can be twisted around to make slings. I also developed something that's a hammock that falls apart halfway through the act.
Huh.
That I think may have been used in other acts afterwards, but for me it was completely brand new and unique. And then I think the other one that people might know us for is called the Aerial Halo, which originally came through Tanya Burka, and she had had someone make a prototype for her that she hung differently than we hang it, and she called it the eyeball. I believe she called it the eyeball. And so when I was inspired to create something, I reached out to her and the manufacturer of that and got their permission to develop that apparatus in a different way. So I was really proud of the community coming together around sort of a new apparatus and giving shared permission to let students work on it in a different way. But we went back to the original creators for that.
Do you have like a philosophy or general like viewpoint of whatever your sort of technique research is and how you do it? Because sort of you've mentioned earlier that that's how you sort of did your original duo trapeze act, was just sort of the self internal research on what tricks can we figure out, what can we do. Is there a method to how you guys approach that, or is it how do you think about it?
Srinidhi and I have, I think, different ways of coming up with new material. And we swap that back and forth depending on what act we're doing. So one of us might come up with a piece of music that makes us visualize a particular thing. One of us will have a dream with an image of standing in a puddle lifting a leg, and that became our single instep trick that a lot of people have seen us do. I think in terms of creation, we spend a lot of time bouncing ideas off of each other, and in our career also off of other people, because we've always been a duo. So we work with not so much the internal put on a video and dance around and see what comes out, but a little bit more of like what a dialogue between two people around the images that are being created and the journey of what you start with. You just keep working on that and adding information from the people who are around until you get to a final goal. Mm. So there's a couple of places in our act that were created by the juggler that was on the tour, because he walked in the room and said, "That's really cool. What would happen if you do this?" So our artistic creative process is communal, I believe, which is sort of how I love circus, is the communal aspect of circus in general.
And I think teaching technique to somebody is probably a little bit more straightforward than what one would imagine you would do. But as far as teaching the artistic side of circus and act creation, how do you think about doing research? How do you communicate that to students?
That's an interesting question, because I work with so many different students, and one of my goals is to not create little Elsies and little Serenities. I don't want the greater circus world to be able to tell that a student graduated from NECA. I want them to know that
That's
a student
a great
graduated
quality,
from NECA.
Because there are a lot of schools where you just go, we said it in another podcast, I don't want to say it here, but I know exactly where that person came from, because it's always the same hand-to-hand technique, or it's always the same swinging trap technique.
Exactly. And we don't want that to happen at NECA. I want to have students feel totally comfortable creating a burlesque act and completely comfortable aspiring to do street performing in Europe, and other people aspiring to a more cirque style, whatever that actually is. And so in the creative process, I find myself using inquiry as opposed to stating to the students what I want them to do. So I will find out what a student is inspired by. In our professional training program, we have a lot of homework assignments that we do with the students at the very start of their program with us, so that we can learn their backstory and what inspires them before we start to layer our perspective on top of them. So that if someone does come in and they're inspired by the music of an Indian sitar player and Malakam work in India, we can make sure that we hold on to that artistic background as we're helping them develop their own fresh and new material.
Do you feel like the students have been getting better or worse, or maybe those aren't good terms to use, but how have they changed in like your years of teaching as far as what kids are coming and asking to learn, or what they already have or don't have?
Certainly technology has changed in the last 10 years. So the ability to videotape yourself and learn from that has shifted, and the ability to watch what other people are creating has definitely shifted. And we're still trying to explore as artistic coaches how to harness those really valuable tools without squashing the individual's creativity. We are so judgmental about what we see of ourselves on video that I fear that a lot of people don't trust the creative process for long enough to be able to find what they can actually make look good. Mm. And I think that's especially true about duo work, because to get two people in sync doing material that has artistic value takes repetition. So that, you know, you step on the left foot at the same time in order to both arrive at the place you want to arrive at the same time. If you videotape that and it doesn't look right because you're off sync, you might be scrapping tons of really valuable research because it doesn't look right, or because you look fat, or because the video camera's making you look flat or slow. So I think there's a real value to being able to videotape and remember research, but I think we're far too judgmental too soon and scrap really valuable material. And then when we get to the research that people do watching other people on YouTube and Vimeo and things like that, I think we are also, as newer students, being super judgmental about our own palette, because we're comparing ourselves usually to professionals or people who are graduating from their third year at the National Circus School in Montreal, for example. And our palette as first year, second year students is not going to be as strong as the palette of a professional. And again, people will scrap their material or copy other people's material because they don't have the palette. And when I say palette, I think of beginner students coming to us with sort of black and white and gray. They have some of the tools. They have a couple of paintbrushes. They can draw outlines and things, but they don't have vibrancy and they don't have the colors. They don't have the physical capacity of virtuosity, and they're judging themselves through video against people who have that virtuosity. And it's a really hard, dissatisfying place to be.
I bet. Also, because some of those videos, it's very hard to tell if people can actually do those tricks more than two times in an hour, or, you know, actually string them together in an act, or you see, particularly I'd say for juggling and acrobatic videos, where you go, oh my God, I cannot believe those people can do those things. But you also don't see, like, the 10 takes where they have missed it just before.
Exactly. And we also don't see where they are compelling humans in a live arena. And
yeah,
circus is a performance art. And I thoroughly believe that in order to be a performance, you need an audience. And so when you're looking at something on video, you're losing three quarters of the really important qualities that make those people circus performers, because you're just seeing the circus.
Having that outdoor space will be amazing for, you know, increasing stage time for students.
Increasing stage time for students, but also increasing the virtuosity of performance, not just the virtuosity of the toolbox and the palette that the students have. We are a trick-based society. I don't know if it's the society of instant gratification that Americans are known for, or the instant gratification that our young people are being trained for. But people are not used to putting in the time and the work. And it takes time to develop that palette. And you need to get on stage multiple times. You need to be in the studio for hours and hours and hours in order to develop that.
So what are you seeing in circus today? Do you feel like the industry is growing or shrinking or just staying the same but changing? What do you think is, what are the main themes that are happening?
I think that circus is in a really interesting place right now that actually started many years ago, so probably 5 or 6 years ago. The demise of Ringling Brothers is a real business decision. It was a very small percentage of Feld Entertainment. And if you look at their decision purely from a financial standpoint, of course you would get rid of the part of the business that is only 2% and isn't doing really well.
And that Disney can't buy.
And that Disney can't buy, exactly. And that model of spectacle becoming too expensive and too hard to manage in the logistics of things, we've been seeing that for a long time. What we are also seeing is the rise of the ensemble company, and that is going to be really interesting to see where it goes. How many ensemble companies can we handle? How can circus become as ubiquitous to the American stage or the American performance audience as dance and music and some of the other things that people just sort of expect to participate in and to watch as audience members. And then we also have the nuances of the American and North American circus world versus what is happening in the rest of the world. And some of the things that we don't have as much control over as artists, I think, are actually the things that are going to result in whether where the future of circus is going to go. So health insurance, employment, taxes and employment rules and laws. Those are two things that are really going to affect the future of circus.
And visas.
And visas.
It's impossible to hire, you know, non-American performers. You're going to have to hire American performers.
Yep. And then we can go into the fundraising side of things, that a lot of really awesome performances are happening in America by foreign companies because they're countries are paying for them to come to America to tour in America, but America, the United States, doesn't pay for American companies to tour in foreign soils.
Or to tour in American soils.
So we're actually, if you're an American company creating new work, you're competing against foreign companies in your hometown.
Isn't that Keith Bindlestiff talked a lot about on his episode about the frustration of having a circus company where you have to go to these same festivals and you're putting up your own cash and they're not at all? Are you guys doing the Smithsonian this summer?
We are doing the Smithsonian this summer, and I struggled to put together a program that wouldn't cost us an arm and a leg to go, but that would also allow us to
pay your way to do a government show.
Yep, and they've come a little ways in terms of a little bit more support for some of the hotel fees and the travel fees, but it is essential pay your way. And it's pay your way for what I think of is going to be a great marketing opportunity to use their name in the future. But I'm still not sure how useful the actual presence on site is going to be. I hope that I will be pleasantly surprised and that there will be a lot of people that will discover circus in an entirely new way. But I sort of doubt that they're going to call NECA and sign up for classes simply because they saw us there. What we're doing is actually a private lesson model. So we are part of the circus school, and I'm sending two of my top aerial coaches, Amy Hancock and Jamie Hodson, and they're going to be teaching private lessons. So if anybody out there is in the Washington, D.C. area or is going to be in the Washington area over the 4th of July holidays, you can take private lessons from NECA coaches.
Definitely
in the air-conditioned building that is part of the Smithsonian event.
So we usually wrap up our podcast with the same three questions we ask all of our guests. The first one being, has there been a piece of advice you've received, good or bad, that has stuck with you?
I think the best piece of advice that I ever got came to me from Boris Varhovsky. I'm saying his last name wrong, but the head coach at Cirque du Soleil. And it wasn't so much a piece of advice, but an acknowledgement of something that I was doing that made me different than other people. So as I mentioned, Serenity and I had really no background when we got hired by Cirque du Soleil. And we were brought up there to train for 9 months to put an act together on swinging trapeze, which we had never done before. And we also had a fixed trapeze section. And we worked our butts off because we felt like I barely deserved to be there. Serenity had more background and training at that point, so she had a little bit more self-awareness of where she was in that space. And we were the first people to be there every day, and we were the last people to leave, and we busted our butts. And 5 months into it, they had us do our act presentation for everybody at the head office. And we actually missed one of the tricks in the swinging section, and we I just kept going. So we kept going with the trick where you sort of like sit up, you switch the safety line over. We looked over at each other and we decided we were going to do it again. I looked at my line holder. I just stood up. The music kept going and I just went ahead, redid the trick, performed the heck out of it, even though we'd missed a trick, came down. And about an hour later, Boris asked us to go into his office and he said, there are a lot of people who did not want you to be here because of your background and because of your age. And the artistic director said they would work with you and the coach agreed to work with you, but I didn't want you here. And I've watched you every single day through this glass door that leads out into the gymnasium. And I noticed that you worked harder than anybody else. We don't have to remind you about the choreography homework that you have to do. You're on time. You're respectful. And congratulations. And that really sticks with me. And I tell that to a lot of people. You can be the most amazing physical performer, and you could be able to pull it out of your butt whenever you need to, if you need to do a standing back tuck. But if you can't remember your passport when you show up at the airport, and if you can't remember your dance belt, and if you're late for rehearsals and you're not warmed up, you're not going to make it in this industry. You're going to make it in this industry, especially in the American circus industry, if you get all your ducks in a row and you're easy to work with and you've got some really great material to put out on stage.
That is awesome advice and very, very true. For somebody who's getting into circus at a very beginner level, is there a movie or a live show or a book or a song or anything as an artistic reference you would suggest they go check out?
When we have our first year students come to us for the first time, we have a couple of pieces of homework that we give them to do. And the first is where they need to provide us with things that inspire them. And that can be an act that they love or a piece of music that they love. And then we give them additional research of the people that we think they need to be aware of. And I tend to go to some of the older performances that are very difficult to find on video, so they're hard to share. There's a trapeze act that Sylvia Zerbini does where she is such a classic traditional performer. She comes in with the little clogs, takes the clogs off, climbs up the rope without using her legs, gets up to the trapeze, and basically sits up there and presents for a little while, puts the chalk on. And does a couple of really, really clean tricks. And by then you're thinking, okay, she's a beautiful performer and she's got some really clean tricks and she looks great. And then she does this crazy beat from the bottom of the bar, half turn to a heel hang.
Whoa.
Really high up in the air with no apparent mats and no safety line. And then it's so amazing that she just goes ahead and she does it again. And that's one of the things that I like my students to see, because you can be so simple about the material that you present, but if you present it with a real honesty, it can be so amazing. And there's a couple other traditional performers that I recommend that people see.
I think that's a great point, because there's so much technique that is forgotten or just lost in time. Mm-hmm. And just by watching old videos, you can find stuff that, you know, you never knew people were doing.
I think that traditional circus is going to very soon become the new wave, because we're starting to get far away from the very simple presentational style of traditional circus. And, you know, probably within 10 years, doing something in that clean presentational way may become the new thing that nobody's ever seen, because it's all about, you know, the complex choreographic wrapping yourself up in the trapezes and the fabrics, and how many million ways can you tie a belay knot in the fabric, which is super, super cool. But we're starting to get used to that as the artistic
model.
Yeah,
it's like a pendulum. It's going to swing back the other direction.
Exactly.
So last question, who else should Lindsay and I interview on the podcast?
I spend so much time with circus instructors that I think the names that really come to my mind when you ask about who you should interview are some of the circus instructors out there. I think that Amy Hancock, who is one of the instructors at the New England Center for Circus Arts, would be a great person. She has a Club Med background, but also a European circus school background, and then has been teaching and performing all over the world and has a really good European sort of aesthetic awareness. And Jamie Hodgson is also a fabulous teacher and has really helped us evolve the educational side of circus, especially in the vertical arts. Some other people that come to mind are Peter Gold, who is a flying trapeze instructor, who was actually the first person to put me on the flying trapeze when he was teaching at Club Med. Then he ended up as a catcher on Ringling Brothers, working with some really famous names. And then he started his own company called Trapeze Experience, teaching self-esteem and, you know, personal growth work using the flying trapeze. And then he recently completed, or is just about to finish up in days now, as one of the people in command at Ringling Brothers, on the boots on the ground people. And I think his perspective about circus in America would be very different than some of the other people that I think you've interviewed. His wife is a Mongolian contortionist, Undharma Gold. Mm. So they share a really broad background that's really different than the contemporary circus background.
Oh, fantastic. And how can listeners find out more about NECA and your fundraising campaign?
We have a website, obviously, which is the New England Center for Circus Arts main website. And if you add /crowdfunding to the end of that, it will take you to our current project, which is raising a little over $90,000 for the equipment that fits inside the facility. So we've got bank loans that help us with setting up the facility that will be opening up June 19th. But we have a lot of stuff that we actually have to pay out of pocket for. And that's the cool stuff for me. That's the, you know, flying trapeze, which is being built by Scott Osgood, who has been making the suspended nets for Cirque du Soleil. It's going to be the 50th trapeze built by Bobby Bates of Bobby's Big Top. And we also have a trampoline and an in-ground pit, and those all cost a lot of money. So the crowdfunding is for $90,000, and you can go on to the website www.necenterforcircusarts.org/crowdfunding.
And if you're listening on your phone, if you hit the info button, you'll see a link to it in the podcast description. Elsie, thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank
awesome
you
talking
so
to you.
Much. It's been too many years since you've driven up and taken classes at our school.
Yes, it has. That was our interview with Elsie Smith.
If you like our podcast, make sure to like us on Facebook, rate us on iTunes, follow us on Instagram, Twitter tweet us, or email us at hello@hideawaycircus.com.
Where should they email us?
Hello. Or email us at hello@hideawaycircus.com. Have a good week. Happy Easter, Passover, and anything else you celebrate.